Today's the second talk in this series about making good choices for a good life. So we'll start out in this room, like we did last week, in silence, during this room. Okay, so sitting in silence for a few minutes together. This gives us the chance to, calm our mind down, let go of a lot of the busy thoughts and busyness in the mind that so often prevents us from really focusing. Yeah, so it's good to do it at the beginning of the session. Otherwise, in the middle of the session, you start thinking here, you start thinking there. Then your body's here, your mind is, running the universe somewhere. But we want to keep our mind and body together. So it's good to kind of try and empty out your mind a lot of these superfluous, distracted thoughts. So as it sits here inside of me. When you're doing it, when you're sitting, just keep normally and naturally, and you can put your focus here on your belly. If you want to, and feel the rise and fall of your belly. Or if you prefer, keep your attention on the nostrils and the upper lip and follow the sensation of the air going up in and out there. Or you can just focus in general on, your air going in and out. If your mind starts wandering to something else, just notice that your mind is wandering and now bring it back. Okay? So your breath is like home. And you keep bringing your focus home. So I'll do it for 3 minutes after my mindset. again, then just sort of asking yourself, what was my initial motivation for coming here? What were the thoughts happening in my mind that got me to move my body to be here this morning? Expand upon that initial motivation and think of the long-term effects of listening to a spiritual talk or a talk that can help you think about your life and what you're doing and how to live a good life. Those are long-term effects on yourself and the long-term effects on others that you haven't done this. Just contemplate that moment. Extend your vision past what's happening in this moment. When we do that, we see that by learning and then putting teachings into practice, our own mind becomes pacified. When our own mind's pacified, we're more at peace inside. Our relationships with others improve. We're able to spread goodness in the world and not hostility. And so that impacts the people around us, and by extension, the people around them, then through the ripple effect to all of the things. And so we cultivate our motivation to be a benefit for all living beings through doing just this one simple action or activity of listening and sharing in its teachings this morning. So we always start out contemplating our motivation and cultivating our motivation, because our motivation is the prime determinant of the value of what we're going to do. And so often in our lives, when we have a thought come in our mind, we're not, you know, the thought is there, and at some level we're aware of it, but at another level we're not aware of what's going on in our mind, and so we act, and then we go, oh my goodness, what in the world am I doing, or what have I done, and we're out of touch with what's going on inside us that moves us to speak, that moves us to do things. So by slowing down in this way and thinking about our motivation, asking ourselves, well, what was my motivation for coming? Yeah. Then we become more aware of what's going on inside of us. And then when we practice consciously cultivating a good motivation, then we're really training our mind and steering it to go in a good direction, instead of just letting our mind be on automatic, you know, with whatever thought or impulse pops into the mind, and then we follow it. Because if we look back over our life, the situations that we've gotten ourselves in that sometimes have been dangerous, or where we have made a mess or been in a mess, or something like that, most of the time we find ourselves in those situations because we haven't been very aware of what our motivation is. And we just kind of follow some idea without thinking about what the effect was. Can you see it in your own mind? I've gotten myself into something. stupid. She went to the kind you don't want to tell your mother about, because she would say, I told you so. You know, it all came about because I wasn't aware of my motivation. So I slowly start out that way. And it's a good practice to do on a daily basis, you know, or throughout the day, whenever you're changing your activities. And I think especially when you get in a car, instead of just jumping in the car, turning the TV, sitting there, where am I going? And why am I going there? Because so often we just get in the car, we don't know where we're going for a ride. Or why? We're contributing to global warming. We're using up these resources. Why? Why are we driving? I'm going to the store to get some cookies. Yeah, but I was just at the store already this morning. And yesterday. And the day before yesterday. So what's going on in my life that I, you know, am always running out to the store to get something? So just, you know, taking that time to really be aware. Then I wanted to review a little bit from yesterday some of the points we talked about. We started talking about what is a good life, and how most of the time we haven't thought about it. Our society and culture tells us what a good life is. Money and reputation and good sex life and lots of possessions and popularity and things like that. Climbing up the job ladder. But I haven't never questioned if that really is the meaning of a good life. And if people who have all those things are actually happy and if they're peaceful inside. And so then I would want to talk about a good life, meaning having internal peace, being in harmony with ourself, so that our mind doesn't get so out of whack depending upon what we encounter in the external world. Okay? So no matter who we're with or what's going on, if we can have some sense of mental, emotional stability, that leads to a good life. And then I also talked about the relationship between ethical conduct and a good life, and how when our mind is kind of out of control with all sorts of thoughts going on in it, and then we tend to do actions that we have regret for later, they're not so ethical. And then, you know, there's a sense of weight on our heart. We don't feel good about ourselves. We don't feel good about what we've done. So, you know, the mind isn't peaceful. The heart isn't peaceful. Okay? Whereas when we have keep good ethical conduct, you know, we avoid creating the causes for a lot of remorse and regret and guilt and sorrow and things like that. Of course, you know, lots of times our mind's out of control and we do something unethical, then what we want to do is repair it. And so there's a purification process, which is really very beneficial spiritually and psychologically, so that we can kind of undo the remnants in our own heart of our incorrect actions, and whereby we can also set determinations to avoid doing it again. Okay, so I'll talk about that. Remind me later, I'll talk about this purification process. Okay, but I won't continue that in my reviewing. Okay. And so then we talked a bit about some of the disturbing attitudes and emotions that make us do unethical actions, that make us unpeaceful inside. Okay? And so we talked about what are often called in Buddhism the three poisonous attitudes. Yeah? So ignorance, and clinging attachment, and hostility or anger. And then yesterday we talked specifically about clinging attachment and hostility, and went over a little bit the effects that they had in our mind and also some of the antidotes to them. So for example, with clinging attachment, contemplating the impermanence of whatever we were attached to, or running the whole video in our mind of getting what we want and then asking ourselves if we were really going to be happy with it. Yeah. And then with anger, you know, one way to oppose it is to see that the person who is doing something that's harmful is unhappy, and that it's actually more appropriate to have compassion for them than to have hatred. And then we also talked about doing some evaluation and seeing if the other person actually has the intention to harm us, or if we are just getting upset even when somebody's trying to help us because things aren't going the way we want. Because a lot of time our anger comes from that. Somebody may be trying to help us, but we, you know, I give the example, somebody cooking us dinner, but it's not ready as soon as we want it, so we get mad, but actually they're doing something kind for us. And so, you know, to not assume that somebody has a bad intention towards us every time, you know, we get upset. Sometimes it's our own mind, you know, upsetting itself. In fact, quite often, I think, it's our own mind upsetting itself. So that was just a little bit to review from yesterday. I thought I would talk a little bit more this morning about what in Buddhism we call the eight worldly concerns. Because these are, this is unpacking the thing of clinging attachment and anger a little bit more. And this topic gets us to look at a lot of our motivations and the effects of those motivations. You know, and then we can use our wisdom to see if that really leads to a good life or not. Okay. So, these eight worldly concerns come in four pairs. Okay. So the first pair is being delighted at having money and material possessions and being despondent when we don't have them. Okay. Sounds pretty normal, huh? The second one is being delighted when people praise us and approve of us, and being despondent when they criticize us and disapprove of us. Sounds pretty normal, right? Third one, feeling delighted and uplifted when we have a good image and a good reputation and we're well known, and then feeling dejected when we have a bad image and notoriety for, you know, some kind of negative feature or something, bad reputation. Again, sounds pretty normal. And then the last one is being delighted when we have nice sense experiences, when we see beautiful objects, hear nice sounds, smell nice things, you know, taste good food, yeah, nice tactile sensations, and then being, you know, upset when we have unpleasant sexual experience. Again, sounds normal. Everybody's like this, don't you think? Yeah? Sounds normal. It's the way the world works. And so our normal way of thinking is that what we want to do is get the first parts of the four pairs and get rid of the last part. Okay? So as much as we can have money and possessions, as much as we can have approval and praise, as much as we can have a good reputation, as much as we can have nice sensual experiences, that's great. That's the purpose of our life. That's what we think is a good life, having all of that. Okay? And then a bad life is having the opposite side, not having money and possessions, getting criticized and having people disapprove of us, having a bad reputation, having unpleasant experiences. That's a bad life. So this is our normal way of thinking. Where does that view of life lead us? where does it take us? It's very normal. We never question it. Yeah? We've never questioned if it's beneficial. We've never questioned if it's realistic. Okay. But where does that view lead us? Because that whole view is based on my happiness and my suffering come from outside. Isn't it? Yeah? My happiness and my suffering come from outside. It has nothing to do with me. So therefore, happiness and suffering come from outside. What I have to do is try and manage the world and control the world so that I'm only surrounded by things that give me pleasure and I'm separated from things that give me pain. I remember yesterday we talked a little bit about our tendency to be control freaks. I want to control the environment and everybody in it. And we talked about how we aren't very successful doing that. Are we? Yeah. We try very hard to control everybody and everything. And really, our success rate is not very good. You know, if we have some kind of business analyst come and investigate this, they tell us we have the wrong strategy for our business. Yeah, because we're not having very good success rate. Because, you know, what do we do to be around nice things? Okay. What do we have to do to try and control the world to be around nice things and nice people? And to get what we want. What do we have to do? It's pretty exhausting, isn't it? When you think about it, it's totally exhausting. You know, because you have to go to work to get the money to buy the clothes that you can go to work in. And to buy the kind of car that you go to work in. Because if you have a certain kind of job, you have to drive a certain kind of car, don't you? And you have to have certain kind of clothes, and you have to hang around with certain kind of people, and that all costs money. So to have the car and the social life and all those things so that you can have your job, so that you can make the money, so that you can have the things you need to have your job, to make the money, so that you can have the things you need. Yeah. Sound like a rat race? Okay. They have a book out called Your Money and Your Life. You know? Vicki Robinson, yes. And Joe somebody. Joe somebody else. Anyway, Vicki is a friend of mine. I never met her. But anyway, it's an excellent book. And they talk about it. You know? How this becomes a circle. Mm-hmm. And then, what else do we need to do to try and make it so that we're around everybody we like? Yeah. Well, we need to give the people we're around a lot of advice. Right? So that they do the things we want. So you know, you don't really need to write to dear Abby and dear, you know, and Landers and stuff, because but those are from one generation.
No, they're still.
Are they still?
Well, people have taken over for them, but it's still the same
thing. Okay, but there's still some, you know, some new people on who are doing this. But we actually, if we look, we have advice for everybody. We don't need to write to ask advice. What should I tell? We have advice for everybody. No? We have advice for our parents, what they should do. We have advice for our children, what they should do. We have advice for our siblings. We have advice for our partners. We have advice for our friends. We have advice for our boss. We have advice for our employees. We have lots of advice for the president. Yeah. But how much do other people listen to our advice? Take the president, for example. How much does he listen to our advice? How much does our boss listen to our advice? How much do the people we live with listen to our advice? How much do we listen to their advice? How do we feel? Switch it around. How do we feel when they give us their advice? You should do this, you should do that. Why in the world are you doing this? That's stupid. Do it that way. How do we react when people give us their sagest advice? Okay. Well, if we're polite, we say thank you, and then we totally ignore it. If we're tired of that strategy, then we say some other things. Okay. Well, that's exactly what they're doing to us. You know, we give all of our advice, you know, and when they're smart, they just say, oh, thank you very much, and they totally ignore it. And then other times they let us know that they don't really want the advice. But, you know, it doesn't necessarily change their behavior, does it? So we try very hard to rearrange the world. And it becomes a struggle for happiness, doesn't it? You look, a lot of times in our life we are struggling for happiness because we're trying to rearrange everything. Now, I'm not saying don't rearrange everything. You know, if you're in a bad situation, I'm not saying stay in that bad situation. You know, if you're living with somebody who beats you, I'm not saying stay married to the guy. Okay? Yeah, so don't get me wrong. But what I am saying is that when we try, when we have the world vision that happiness and suffering comes from outside, we get ourselves in a situation where we never really have peace. Monastic clothes were not made for this. So we're trying to rearrange the world as struggling for happiness and actually feeling quite a bit of frustration in the process. So that worldview and that strategy really don't work very well. What the Buddha did was he did this. The suffering is coming from outside. But the Buddha said was, you know, check in your own mind and really see if happiness and suffering come from outside or not. Yeah. Check in your own mind and how much does your mind contribute to whether you're happy or whether you're miserable. Have you ever been in a situation with other people and found that you've interpreted the situation much differently than other people have? Yeah. So that other people may be unhappy but you feel unhappy, or maybe other people are happy but you feel unhappy because there's a difference in interpretations. But whatever our interpretation is, we're convinced it's right. And we're convinced that we're seeing the objective truth as the situation is out there. But these situations where our interpretations don't match what's happening with other people, you know, their interpretations are very good for getting us to ask, you know, is my mind interpreting things correctly? Is happiness or suffering coming from outside? I love to share this story because it was such a wake-up call for me. It happened, you know, before I became a Buddhist. But when I was a traveler, a trekker in the Himalayas, I had actually encountered Buddhists, and, you know, you see all these Buddhist things in the Himalayas. But
at Ashland and we got it for them. Anyway, we were coming down to Marchbeck, and we were at a little airport, if you want to call it that, called Lukla. This was in 1973. Okay, so it was a while ago. Lukla Airport at that time was a grassy plain sloping downwards with a cliff at the end. And a crashed plane. Okay, so that was Lukla Airport, that, and we wanted to fly out, and that's what that was. And our plane wasn't, somehow it was delayed, it wasn't going that day. Anyway, we were sitting there, you know, wondering, well, where are we going to stay that night? And one man came up to us who lived in the village, and he said, you know, come and stay in my house. And, you know, we'll take care of you, and tomorrow you can catch the flight. Well, the person I was with thought, wow, what a kind man, you know, he's offering to help us, and he knows we're stranded. We'll stay in his house, we can, you know, give him some compensation or something and do that. And my mom said, oh, he just knows that we're stranded foreigners and he's going to rip us off. Yeah? Same situation. I was so cynical and skeptical and quite unhappy. And my friend was, you know, seeing kindness and feeling quite grateful for the guy. What a good example, isn't it? Of just how our own mind interprets things. So this is going on all the time when we're trying to rearrange the world, when we're trying to get the first four of the, you know, four parts of the eight-worldly concerns and avoid the last four. Right? That actually what we're calling happiness depends a lot on our interpretation, a lot on the story we tell ourselves. So remember yesterday when I was talking about putting the attachment, and I said it depends on exaggerating the good qualities of someone or something, or projecting good qualities that aren't there? Here we can see quite clearly that our mind projects something that isn't there, but that we're totally 100% convinced is there, and therefore we get attached. And we see that thing as something really wonderful, really good, and then we have to have it. And similarly with something that we want to avoid, the last four, you know. We say this is terrible, it's going to bring these awful consequences, I'm going to be miserable, and then we get upset, we're trying to avoid it. But if we start to question our interpretation about a lot of these things, we really see how much projection and exaggeration and mistaken view there is involved. So let's take, you know, food is a good example of things that we get attached to because it's something that we all share. Okay? So you're sitting in here and, you know, it approaches lunchtime, or even before it approaches lunchtime, you know, and you start thinking about what's for lunch and what you want to have for lunch, okay? And then you spend some time, you know, thinking about, well, what's going to make me really happy today that I feel like eating? Okay. So look at what we were using our precious human life for. Yeah, figuring out what we're going to eat. Okay, we spend a great deal of time about it. Now, I notice when people go out to restaurants, they'll spend a half an hour talking about what to order. You know, that's part of your eating out together. Do the noodles have peas? Are the peas cooked very well? And on and on. And then when we get the, you know, we form an image in our mind of what this food is going to taste like. Yeah. And then we have an image of how much happiness we're going to get from it. And then when the food comes and we eat, how much are we paying attention to the food? Do you sit there in silence eating
completely concentrating on the taste of the food so you experience every biteful? No. What are we doing when we're eating? We're talking to other people. Are we tasting our food? Maybe a little bit. Okay? Enough to form an opinion. So that we'll have something else. Before we order the food, we talk about what we're going to get, and then after it comes, we talk about the food. But how much we actually taste the food is another question. Okay? So there's some exaggeration going on here. And then, of course, how long does it take to eat the food?
Yeah,
2 minutes maybe, half an hour. And then all happiness is totally over, isn't it? Totally over. But then you go home, and when you talk to your friends, you talk about the food that you ate, and which restaurants are good and which ones aren't so good, and how the food tasted and how nicely it was laid out and served.
And spend more time talking about it than
what you taste. Exactly. More time talking about it than eating it. And definitely more time talking about it than tasting it. Because when we have the exercise to eat in silence and keep our attention focused on the taste of the food, it's really difficult. Try that sometime. Yeah, try eating in silence, chewing your food very slowly so you taste it very well, and only focusing on the taste of the food without thinking about anything else, like getting more. Okay, so you're not allowed to think about how you can eat quickly so that you can get more before anybody else does. Yeah, that thought comes in your mind, you gotta kick it out. So you just gotta focus exactly on the taste. See how long you can do that and how much happiness that brings you. Yeah? Seriously, try it. Very interesting experiment. So what I'm getting at is a lot of the things that we think are going to bring us happiness, if we really check, don't necessarily bring us happiness. They might help us fit in with everybody else because we're all talking about the same delusion and the same illusion. But we're not necessarily happy. Similarly, you know, we were talking yesterday when Prince Charming shows up, okay? Now, Princess Charming shows up, you know, the one and only person who's going to be everything for you, you know, fulfill all your needs, understand you completely, never reject you, always be there when you need them. Now, isn't this your definition of what your partner should do? And of course, if somebody says that to us, you know, I expect you to always be there for me, to always encourage me when I'm down, to always match my mood when I'm in a good mood. You should be in a good mood and be funny when I'm serious. You should also be serious when I'm in a bad mood. You should uplift me. You know, you should always want to do the same thing I want to do. You should always look nice. You should never age. You should never yell at me. You should never complain about me. Okay? So if somebody else has the same definition of a partner that we do and they verbalize it to us, I want you to be my partner and here are the conditions that you have to fulfill. What are you going to say? Get me out of here! I can't do that! You know? Can you promise to always be here for somebody? Can you promise to always be in the same room as them? But that's what we expect everybody else to be for us, don't we? Prince Charming's supposed to do that. Princess Wonderful's supposed to do that. And
and then they don't. Incredible suffering. When they do, when they do, then we're delighted. It's the first part of the eight world consensus. And then when they don't, so when they're really gushing, you're so wonderful, I love you, you're the best thing in the world, and they sing all those love songs, then we just go, somebody loves me, I'm wanted, I'm needed, I'm important, I'm special, I'm worthwhile. And then later on, when they're in a bad mood, and they say, you were supposed to meet me at 5 o'clock and you were late and you didn't call. Why are you wearing those clothes? That doesn't look right. Don't you know what kind of situation we're going to? You have to look good. Because you're coming with me. And why do you want to go to that trashy movie anyway? You don't have any good taste in movies. You don't have very good taste in food either. You forgot my birthday. Did you buy me anything for my birthday? You spent all the money in a way that I don't want it spent. And then when they say those things to us, then what happens? Oh, you've got to go to the used husband shop. Why is the divorce rate so high? Because we have such incredible unrealistic expectations of other people. So, this is all coming about. So much expectation, so much projection. And so, we think if somebody's like this, then we're just going to be always happy. But they don't have the ability to make us happy. And those specific actions, sometimes they do the same thing that makes us happy, but it doesn't make us happy because we're fickle. Sometimes we have to admit that, don't we? And then, they do all these other things that we don't like. And we exaggerate the harm of the other things that they do that we don't like. And then we rev up our anger. And then we have so many problems, don't we? So you're trying to do shopping this week, honey. And you forgot the honey. And you know I like honey and I don't like sugar. And you know that we were out of honey. And last week you forgot the peanut butter. Well, actually, you did, but you got creamy peanut butter instead of the chunky kind that I like, and you know I love chunky peanut butter. I think there's something passive aggression going on. I was thinking about it this morning when I got distracted in my meditation. We've been married 10 years, and there's many situations of this passive aggressive behavior. We've all but forgotten the chunky peanut butter just once. This is a continual repeated. I think you don't love me anymore. In fact, maybe you never loved me. This is what we do. This is exactly what we do. One small thing, and we exaggerate, we make a whole story about it, we get such incredible mental turmoil, emotional torment. This person that I thought loved me doesn't love me after all. And what's my evidence? They forgot to buy the honey and they got the wrong kind of peanut butter. That's the evidence. Look at our relationships and what we get upset about. And look at what we make stories about in in the relationships with the people we care the most about. Okay. So, to come back to this thing, when we have the worldview that happiness and suffering are outside of us, that's when we get involved with all these projections, all these stories, all this attachment, all this aversion. Okay? And we get into this incredible struggle for pleasure. If we scratch a little bit deeper, yeah, what else is there underlying this worldview? Okay, so part of the worldview is happiness and suffering come from outside. What's another part of that worldview? My happiness is more important than anybody else's. Don't you think? Isn't that part of our worldview? Yeah? Why do we get so attached to having nice people and things around us and so upset when unnice things and people around us? You know? Because we can think our happiness is the most important in the world. What do we get most upset about during the day? Yeah? Or put it this way, how upset or which makes us more upset? You know, the car bomb in Iraq or some nasty thing a colleague sent to us at work. What do we get more upset about? The nasty thing somebody said to us at work. Why? Because part of our worldview is my happiness is most important. And what somebody said about me at work, you know, influences my happiness more than, you know, somebody else who I don't know getting run a car blast and a car bombing in Iraq. And so, you know, it's kind of embarrassing to talk about how self-centered we are, isn't it? Mm-hmm. Yeah? But, you know, we're being honest with these things. We're fessing up to a lot of things. Mm-hmm. You know, we're all like this. So let's just, you know, I don't want to say we're in good company. We're in company. We're all selfish. Yeah. Okay. But this self-centered attitude actually makes us quite miserable. Mm-hmm. Because the self-centered attitude makes us so concerned with every small thing that's happening in our life that we lose the big picture. And we become so easily annoyed and irritated and dissatisfied with small things happening in our life because these small things seem enormous to us. Now somebody is 10 minutes late for an appointment and we are really upset. Yeah. Why do we get so upset about somebody being 10 minutes late for an appointment? We're making some kind of story, aren't we, to justify our upset. But is that story of any importance in the big picture? No. So who's making us upset? The person who is 10 minutes late and didn't call us? Or ourselves? Who's making us upset? Our own mind is making us upset, isn't it? Because of the way it's thinking at that moment. And we're putting more value on some small thing than it's actually worth. And then I love to use the example, the people in the Abbey do it all the time. You know how some people put cups in the cabinet upside down and some put the cups right side up? Yeah? If you're an upside down person, why do you do it? So the dust doesn't get in the cups, right? You do it for sanitary reasons. if you keep your cups upright, right side up in the cupboard, why do you do it? Because the soap might be dirty, and you don't want to get the ring on where you drink dirty. So also for health reasons. But if you're an upside down person and you live with a right side up person, you have some conflict in that. I don't know how many housemates have moved out, you know, because we can't agree on how to put the cups in the cupboard. Because if you're an upside down person, we are so attached to our way of doing it that we can't consider doing it upright side up, and vice versa. And it becomes incredibly important. My way of doing things is right. And we are very attached to my way of doing things. Yeah? And if somebody doesn't agree with my way of doing things, they are wrong. They are bad, they are sinful and evil, and they are worthy of my anger. But who suffers when we get angry? We do. We're furious because yet again our stupid housemate put the blue cup right side up in the cupboard. Yeah, we are furious. Is our housemate upset? No. Who's unhappy? We are. Who's making us unhappy? We are. Why? Because we're so focused on my idea, my way, everything centered around me, that the mind's inflexible. Mine is inflexible. And if we look, you know, at work or at home, you know, at school, these kind of conflicts happen so much because we have really different ways of doing things. Yeah? And this is a small example, but there's so many other examples. And most of them are probably equally as small when you come down to it. But we get very attached to our way of doing things and very annoyed, you know, because my idea is me. Yeah, there's that notion going on inside. My idea is me. So if somebody doesn't think my idea is the best one, then they don't think that I'm good. Is that true? My idea is me? No. My idea is not me. My idea is just some blip on the mental screen. And we change ideas a lot too, don't we? Mm-hmm. Yeah. Especially at work. You know, when you're working on a project, have you seen how you'll have one idea how to do it? Then you'll think about it, you get another idea, then you think about it some more, you have another idea. But at each step, during that whole week that we're having at least 7 different ideas, one time a day, one idea a day, probably more, and then all 7 ideas are different. Whatever idea we have at one particular time, we think that idea is me. And we're attached to it, and somebody who doesn't agree with it is threatening me. And then when I change to another idea the next day, then somebody who doesn't like my idea the previous day, I no longer get mad at them. But I get mad at the person who doesn't like Tuesday's idea rather than Monday's idea. I don't like this, no. So who's causing the suffering? Us. Yeah. We often cause our own suffering so much. Incredible. Okay? So, let's draw this back to having a good life. Yeah. We want to have a good life. We want to have a peaceful mind. We want to have a peaceful mind, we need to be much less self-centered. Because the more we focus on ourselves and take ourselves so seriously and make a big deal about everything that happens to us, the more miserable we are.
So this whole philosophy in our society, you know, which is self now, everything is the individual, everything is the self. Yeah, there was a magazine called Self. And they asked me, they wanted to use something I wrote to put in this magazine. So I checked it out on the web, you know, and how exactly they phrased it, but it was something, you know, the thing with the magazine is you should get what you want. Oh my goodness, what a dead end going through life thinking I should get what I want. Yeah, because the more we go through life thinking I should get what we want, what I want, the more unhappy we're going to be when we are, when we don't get what we want, because we can't control it. Okay? Yeah? Whereas when we're more open-minded, when we have less attachment, less clinging, yeah, then whatever comes our way, you know, we're okay with it. There's so much more peace in the life. So one way to have a more peaceful mind is to become less self-centered, not more, okay? And to be less attached to getting our way, rather than more attached to getting our way. Yeah. That doesn't mean that we don't have opinions and that we don't think about things and analyze things. I mean, if you're at work and you have a project to do, you have to think about it, you have to come up with ideas. You know, yeah. So I'm not saying don't think, yeah. But we still have to think about how to, you know, do this project and how to make this happen. But it's the getting attached to our ideas that becomes difficult. Okay? Yeah. And I'm not talking about, you know, just having some kind of blasé thing that, oh, it's all good and it's all bad, you know, there's no good and there's no bad, so whether I lie or whether I tell the truth, it doesn't really matter, you know, because if I'm attached to telling the truth, that's just another attachment. That way of thinking is rubbish. Okay? Yeah. I was saying that because sometimes people, you know, can take certain things to an extreme. No, we should very clearly be able to discriminate what is ethical conduct and what isn't ethical conduct, and what is appropriate behavior for a situation and what isn't appropriate behavior for a situation. Okay? But it's when we get attached to this and we're, you know, we become a born again whatever, trying to convince everybody else, yeah, in a very pushy, forceful way. That's when suffering starts to happen, okay? Or when we let our ethical ideas become the fuel for judging other people, okay? Witness the whole abortion debate, yeah? Okay? So it's possible to have a position on the abortion debate, but without judging the other people who have a different idea. But what's happening a lot is people get attached to their ideas and then use that to fuel their anger against people who have different ideas. That's not very helpful. Okay? But it is helpful to have certain ethical ideas. We need to have principles in our life and standards and, you know, to guide us in our life.